you seen them?
Yeah.
All I have in this world is my balls, my word.
The African anteater ritual.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Someone should tell that girl, you don't have to take your clothes off.
Amanda Jones is no minor leaguer who will be swept off her feet at the touch of your amateur lips.
Call me Mr. Butterfingers.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
I love you guys.
Hey, 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 it's the big master control program everybody's been talking about.
I'm so sure.
I'm Spun Counter Guy. Thanks for stopping by in the corner back by the woodpile. Maybe it's some kind of midlife crisis, but man, for the past year or so, I've looked back intensely at the decade that I came of age, the 1980s. I guess I could do like many men do and go out and buy a sports car, start leaving my shirts unbuttoned down to my navel, blow dry my chest hair, and then chase young girls to defy the fact that I'm closer to the graveyard than to the cradle. But my good wife would probably frown on that. So instead, I decided to start a podcast series dubbed A Fluorescent Decade on a Hill, where my friends and I would honor the said era by sharing our bodacious memories of it. Some of the testimonies were a reflection of the culture at large, while others were indicative of particular regions. And then there were the personal tales that could have happened at any age. A few things that I think made the 80s special was that the music didn't appear to be as confined to the stale pop songwriting craftsmanship that seems to have plagued other decades. The weirder the sound was, the better. Politically and historically, a sense of optimism seemed to reign, at least in the free West, that hadn't been seen since John Kennedy was president. Economically, the tide was lifting most boats from the previous decade's quagmire of inflation, unemployment, price controls, and skyrocketing energy costs. Television and movies of the time also contrasted with the gloomy plots of the 1970s, where maybe the best cinematic offering of comedy still ended with a self-righteous old lady committing suicide. And aesthetically, I feel the 80s was the last decade that had a distinctive style, particularly with fashion. Even though I love how in the 90s and ever since people have been able to express themselves as individuals without garnering as many gasps, stares, and scornful looks, the multiple instances of us fools worrying about being cool and fitting in have produced some hilarious and humbling stories. Now, not everyone will agree completely with my assessments of the decade, but we'll get to those varied opinions later. Well, actually, here's one criticism. Many of the social commentators deem that the 80s were a decade of materialism. My first challenge of that notion is to ask those critics to name any time or place in any part of the world that wasn't fascinated with material things. I can even think of one time seeing a lady in a very primitive third world country pulling a goat and donning a necklace made out of a bent bottle cap. My second reaction to the social scientist naysayers would be to suspect those kinds of snobby assessments come from individuals living comfortably in major cities, they having access to material goods the rest of us only dreamed about having. At least the way I remember it was that in the 80s, trendy items finally became affordable and available to everyone, be they poor or way out in the boonies. My mother had had to hand make a lot of my sister's dresses until such clothes became affordable enough to just buy without having to take months to craft. That said, the first thing almost all the females I interviewed brought up was the loud fashion of the 80s they were able to strut around in.
All the women would wear fluorescent clothes, like bright acid lime green and bright traffic orange.
And you were into it?
Oh, I don't know that I was into it, but I wore it. Looking back on it, we all realized we looked like crap in it, but I mean, everybody looked dead. Skin against fluorescent colors was hideous. And then everybody's big hair. You spent tons of time on your hair, and you always had some kind of hair accessory in, like hair bands or barrettes or the banana combs. And the bigger hair you had, the better it was. And I had insane hair. I had really big hair.
So all the guys wanted you, huh, for your big hair?
No, I don't think so. No, we thought we were cool, but right. Yeah, I mean, that was just the style. And the jelly shoes, especially if you had fluorescent jelly shoes, then you were really cool.
Did you have them?
Yeah, I did.
So
I had
really
some
cool,
like bright, bright yellow.
Were they comfortable?
Jellies. You know, they were really good on the beach. Mm-hmm. Because the sand would go right through them.
Right.
But other than that, they weren't great. On a hot day, your feet would get all sweaty on the bottom.
Yeah.
It was gross.
You Yeah, it seems everyone had a jelly shoe story.
Jelly shoes are made out of plastic, like hardcore plastic. Like when you open the box, you get high on the smell of plastic. At least in my time.
Right.
I was never able to wear the jelly shoes because I grew up in Lubbock, Texas, which is like 100 degrees in the shade, and it's really sandy. It's really dusty, and I am apparently allergic to plastic shoes. I bought a pair, and my feet broke out in blisters, and it was the most horrible time of my life.
Wow. Did you suffer because you couldn't wear jelly shoes during that time?
Well, yeah, it was embarrassing. Everybody else could wear them. I mean, our feet stunk up to high heaven. Like, we could smell our feet out of the jelly shoes because it was just, like, pure plastic. And then you would sweat, and it was just nasty. But everybody had them except for me.
Aww.
Well, I did attempt to wear jelly shoes with socks.
Uh-huh.
But that just was not as cool.
Were you laughed out of the school?
Well, I was looked at weirdly. My sister said that was not cool, and that was that.
Okay.
And I never knew if she was saying that just to be mean to me,
mm-hmm.
or to take away the jelly shoes. We were the same size, and mine were sparkling, and hers were like pink or something.
And she wore them after you gave them to her?
Of course she did. She didn't have anything wrong with her feet. But I tried to buy Leanne jelly shoes.
Are they back?
They are back. I mean, it's like the whole nightmare again. It's like they stink. She comes home and her feet are like full of dirt and mud, and you know, they with the sweat, it gets all muddy and it's gross, and then she makes me clean between her toes with like wipes. So I'm like, yeah.
They look rad though.
They did.
Okay, so I remember when jelly shoes were really popular,
mm-hmm.
and I was a little girl. And I didn't get to get new anything very often, so like a new pair of shoes is very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember getting a pair, and I think they were like pink, clear plastic, maybe even with glitter. It's
Ooh,
possible.
Oh, look out.
fingers crossed there was glitter in there. And I thought that they were totally amazing. And my mom and I would walk everywhere. I think that was during a time, I was maybe like 4 or 5. I think she didn't have a car at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would stay with a friend near the downtown area of our town. And then we would walk all around there, and she would find work and stuff. And so I remember walking a lot, and that they were kind of slippery because, you know, like my feet were sweating and they didn't have anything to absorb it. So that was kind of weird. But I liked them because they were so pretty. And then apparently I got a wart on my toe, and my mom like freaked out, and she was really upset about it. Like, she kind of overreacted. I mean, and she decided that it was because of my jelly shoes that I got the wart. Like, that was the source of
so they're made out of toads, obviously.
Yeah, maybe they are toads with glitter.
Yeah,
glitter toads.
Yeah.
So she took them away, so I couldn't wear them anymore, and I only got to wear them for like a month or something. And she decided that they were evil, and that I couldn't have them anymore, which was really kind of sad.
Do you feel like your social status like went up a notch when you had the jelly shoes at school?
Well, I wasn't in school yet, mm-hmm. but I would say that I was proud and excited, and that I probably pranced around with some extra swagger,
right.
I'm sure, because I used to like to go talk to everybody when we would go into the center of town. I would go introduce myself to
you
strangers.
Say,
and
hello, my name is Danica, and these are my jelly shoes.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're glad to meet you as well.
Yeah, totally. Well, I come from a very hippy-dippy place,
mm-hmm.
and my husband was, I was telling him about it earlier, and he said that he thought that it was a great representation of the strange place that we come from. The fact that she would assume that it was the shoe's fault is, mm-hmm. like, not based in logic at all.
Right.
She was, like, randomly assigning blame,
right.
for no good reason.
I had this outfit, and I thought I was so cool. I remember going to Mud Island. It's really a cool place in Memphis. It actually is a mud island right there down by the Mississippi River. I wore a pair of culottes. Do you know what culottes are?
Yeah.
Culottes were big then, which they're so back in style now. Yeah. And I so want a pair because I love my culottes. They were white and trim. They were piped in red. And then the collar was piped in yellow. And I had on my clear jelly shoes. And I wore yellow hoop earrings. Dude, I mean, I was, hey, I thought I looked good.
I know it's your wife, but I'm getting hot over it.
The first time that I went to Mud Island, that was my outfit. I will never forget that outfit. I wish I had saved my jelly shoes and my culottes.
Now, did anybody notice you?
Oh, of course. Of course. And I was rocking braids. I was rocking braids at that time. I really thought I was like, yeah, it's so tight, you know. Traveling from Little Guys, Tennessee to Memphis, Tennessee, that was big because where we're from, you know, you'd have to travel about an hour and a half just to do some decent shopping and to see, you know, just a little bit more culture. So that was a big deal where I was from.
At the end of that day on Mud Island, how were your jelly shoes and your feet?
Oh my gosh. They were hot and dusty.
Sweaty? Nasty? Stinky?
They were pretty nasty. They weren't sweaty. You know, I just don't have sweaty feet. I just don't.
And lastly, I brought up the subject of jelly shoes with my mom and one of my sisters.
So tell me about jelly shoes.
They're shoes made out of plastic and rocks get stuck in the bottom of them.
And did you have some?
No.
Why not?
My mom said they would hurt my feet.
And mom, were you right?
You tell me.
I don't know. I never got a pair.
You said girls at school had band-aids.
Oh, yeah, they
on
all
them.
Had band-aids. They all had bloody scabs on the back of their feet.
But, I mean, did they get them cool points or the boys like that?
They were cool.
Was there anything else do you remember that you wanted from that time?
Hey. A dummy.
A ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah.
And a monkey.
Yeah. And did you get either?
No.
You're still waiting?
Yes.
Okay, mom.
You did have a pair of jelly shoes eventually. I think they were kind of like a whitish cream color. You bought them, I think.
Did they hurt my feet?
They probably so. Okay.
Mom, why didn't you get her a dummy or a monkey? And you wanted a live monkey, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, monkeys are nasty.
And illegal.
And cause problems. What was the other thing?
I wanted to be a ventriloquist. Because just like
they were over $50, and people think they want things, and when they get it, it sits in the closet, and they never play with it again.
I was going to be like the Peyton sisters.
The Pate girls.
Yeah, the Pate girls. They were...
Like a local celebrities?
No, they were...
A Nazarene pastor's daughters, and they did a little...
At the talent show, they always had their little...
Oh, so that's dummies. Where you got the idea. They had dummies. They all had, each had a dummy?
Yeah, and talked for it.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
They were decent.
Yeah.
But you did good in the talent shows with whatever you did.
Drama.
You throw the baton or anything?
No.
You played the piano and sang and did drama.
But I didn't have a dummy.
Well, have you bought Braylon a dummy yet?
She didn't ask for a dummy.
Okay.
She's got American Girl dolls.
What is that?
I then called my other sister and reported what she and I remember, which differed slightly from what you just heard.
The way we remember it, because we talked on the phone about this, was then one day you did come home with jelly shoes and they wore them to the next day of school and people laughed at him because they had gone out of style. And I guess you got them for a pretty good price.
Probably so.
Yeah,
that's what Jennifer said. I don't remember it.
And then she also said, maybe you can chime in on this, there was a shoe called Kangaroos.
And I don't remember that.
Well, they were, I don't know if they were the next or before that, but they were a hot thing and they had little pockets, you know, because
Kangaroos. Oh, yeah, you could put your milk money in there.
So you remember, Ian?
Yes, I remember, Derek, you'd be sitting at a desk and you'd look over and somebody was unzipping their shoe and getting out their milk money. And that was super cool.
Yeah, well... The way my sister remembers it is that mom couldn't afford or something the Kangaroos, so she found some other knockoff shoes.
It was she sewed a pocket to our shoe.
Well, the way Jennifer remembers it was some other marsupial animal like possum roos or something that had a pocket. And you guys wore those to school and got laughed out of it.
I don't remember that either.
I do remember one time we were someplace and they were some generic shoes, but Jennifer wanted them. Uh-huh. She thought she wanted them. And so I bought them. And then somebody must have made fun of her the next day at school because she never wanted to wear those shoes again. So I was stubborn. I would not buy her any more shoes. The next pair of shoes she had to buy for herself.
Wow. So the other thing I was going to mention, at church camp, there was a girl who was kind of husky, wealthy, and she never really had friends, but she had people that she kind of pushed around and made her friends. She'd find the weak ones in the bunch. And I remember being one of the weak ones for a little while. She told me what to do, and I hung out with her. And then, you know how church camp works, it was, you get there on Monday, and then you go home on Friday. Well, Thursday was where all the magic happens, if it's going to happen. Like, you know, couples get together or friends, like, or
get invited to the banquet.
Yeah, they do things like, hey, let's do our last hurrah. And I remember on Thursday night, the husky girl had no friends left. She had ran them all off, or they'd grown tired of her. And I remember she was crying, and I thought, that's interesting. She has jelly shoes, and yet nobody likes her. And that was like a big revelation to me. So
jelly shoes aren't everything.
Pranks certainly weren't unique to the 80s, but it might have been the last era where one could play a joke without getting sued or sent to sensitivity classes. Here's one that resulted in a yet still unsolved act of terrorism that occurred in a small community in upstate New York.
In 1984, I had just graduated high school, so I still had my cap and gown. And I overheard my little brother, it was going to be his first time going out trick-or-treating with his friends at night, and they had shaving cream and eggs, and it was kind of a coming-of-passage night for them. And I'm doing my homework for the community college I was at. Overheard him, okay, I'll see you here in 15 minutes. So I wait a few minutes, and then just nonchalantly, I got up out of the office, got the gown on, and I took a black t-shirt, put it over my head, and I tied the sleeves around the back just so there were little slits where my eyes were. I looked like a ninja. And then I walked through the house, and obviously nobody had seen me. And I got the sword off the mantle. So I just walked across the street, and it wasn't long till I just crouched behind the mailbox because I could hear the little friends coming. And they're getting closer, and they're getting closer. Finally, I jump out from the mailbox with the sword, and I'm like, ah! And I just waved the sword up in the air, and they all, and they fell backwards and got up and ran, just screaming like little girls. And so I just walked across the street, walked up into the house, put the sword back, put the t-shirt back, put the gown back in the laundry room, and went back to my homework, and the phone's ringing. My mom's like, what? And then she hangs up and the phone rings again. She's like, yeah, I just heard. And then all of a sudden I hear police sirens.
Oh, no.
Honestly, I'm thinking, what's wrong? What happened? Because there's absolutely no way, like, whatever I did was, like, that serious.
Police worthy.
And then come to find out, this big monster in it with a beard attacked these kids and was lunging at them with the sword. And the guy with the sword, like, was poking at him, and the kid rolled away, and he got up and he kicked the assailant, the perpetrator. You know, this whole elaborate story of how brave they were. In fact, when they first started telling me the story, it was like, it was so different than actually what happened. I'm like, are you serious? Mm-hmm. Like, for a second, I believed them that there was some crazy guy out there. I'm like, wait, they're talking about what I just did.
Why they had the beard, do you think?
You know, I think it was the ninja mask, like just the t-shirt over my head. It's just the glimpse they got. Mm-hmm. You know, so obviously Halloween was canceled in my neighborhood that year because the phones were lighting up. The police were everywhere looking for this guy.
Did you ever fess up?
Years later. I'm like, hey, you remember that Halloween?
So there's a file.
I didn't even think about it.
So there's a file on you, basically.
Probably, yeah.
A bearded ninja.
As evidenced by another podcast series I started, Songs from a 1980s Roller Rink Dumpster, one of my pet projects is to champion some of the great musical acts that existed below the surface of Top 40 radio. And so here's one tribute from a fellow DJ friend of mine.
You know, back in the 70s, we had the disco era. But as we was leaving the 70s, going into the 80s, all the big time wigs got together in Comiskey Park and set all of the disco records on fire.
Well, listen, we took all the disco records that you brought tonight. We got them in a giant box. And we're going to blow them up real good.
All the rockers.
Yeah.
They always hated disco.
They hated disco. they just felt it was too flamboyant for us, you know. So they got together and they just had a bonfire day. You know, some black people, you talk to them and they say, we think it was kind of also racially motivated also. Because then just, if you was black or queer to them, they thought, no, this is how it's going to be from this point on. So this is where Jack Master Funk comes in. Father Jack Master Funk was a DJ in Chicago in the 70s too.
You're in the mix with Farley Jack Master Funk on 102.7 FM, BMX.
And you know, in the 70s, they just played long music. Like, they would play disco music for a long time. And so what Farley did is, he's got all the songs together and start chopping them up into like a fourth of the song. And he'll mix another song in there. His craft really pretty wasn't that well. You know, he couldn't really match the beats. Mm-hmm. So this is how the story goes now. I don't know, but this is what I heard. So what Farley Jack Master Funk did to be the best DJ in Chicago, because that's when, in the 80s, that's when DJs started going rampant. Everybody started mixing and everything, because New York had what? The scratching. Well, Chicago was different. They knew how to blend, how to mix. And that's why we are the DJs that we are today.
That's why we try, yeah.
Yeah. So what he did is he locked himself in the basement. Like I said, I don't know how true this is. He locked himself in the basement for 3 days till he developed the craft, you know, of mixing one song to the other, seamless, perfect. And when he came out, he was the best DJ in Chicago. And he was mixing like different types of songs, playing songs backwards and mixing them. And then they found this drum machine, which they threw away from Detroit. That was this drum machine they had in Detroit. They threw it away. One guy from Chicago went inside the garbage and pulled the drum machine out. And so they started having drum machines and turntables and everything. But he revolutionized DJing. If it wasn't for Farley Jack Master Funk, we would just be sitting there playing one song after the other and just looking at it.
So you feel he was the first beat matcher?
He was the one that did it seamless. He was the one to make that transition from Al Green to Donna Summers, from Donna Summers to Bobby Womack. Seamless. Farley Jack Master Funk, to me, never went commercial. He always stayed underground. He traveled to different places like England, Germany, France, places like that, and made a big name of himself. But people from Chicago, we worship him. People in Europe worship him. But he never was on that stage, that commercial stage.
A lot of folks that got born in the 90s and beyond were the result of romance in the 80s. Here's how a beautiful teenage girl of today named Olivia came to be.
In 87, we were at a pool party. And there was a bunch of people I didn't know. And I looked across the pool and I saw him. And I remember telling my best friend, I'm going to marry that boy.
Really? She's
like, you don't even know him.
You were 13 years old?
13 years old.
Wow.
I thought he was the cutest boy I'd ever seen in my life.
Aww.
It was so weird.
What was it about him? Just
I don't know. Because now I look back at pictures of him at that age. He was funny looking. But for some reason.
Did he have a demeanor or?
No, because he was really shy. I think I have a thing for shy guys. So my brother and his friends were talking to him. And it's like he couldn't speak. It was so weird. And when he did talk, he talked to himself like this. Like Olivia talks.
Uh-huh.
And I was just like, okay, what is wrong with this boy? Why doesn't he want to talk to me? He's really cute. He's going to talk to me, whether he wants to talk to me or not. And after that pool party, I didn't see him again for like almost a year, for a whole year.
Did you think about him for a whole year?
No, not at all. Until I saw him the next time, and it was just like, wow.
Which was yeah. Where?
It was at a friend's house. And it's amazing how we didn't even live in the same parts of town, how we just kept kind of meeting. It was weird. Right. I think that relationship was meant to be. So after that second meeting, we were quote unquote boyfriend and girlfriend.
Could you go on dates at that time, or you just talk?
We talk on the phone, and we'd sneak out of the house, get one of his friend's bikes, and ride over to our house, and we'd sit in the grass outside and hold hands and talk. And aww. Yeah, it was sweet. It was really sweet and innocent.
What did you talk about?
Everything about his family, my family, church. You know, he grew up Church of God in Christ, so they're just really, really weird. They might as well be Amish people. They go to church every day. The girls can't wear skirts. They can't wear shoes, open-toed shoes. They can't wear makeup. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of his secret for a long time because, yeah, I did everything that they were totally against. Mm-hmm. And then after we had been dating for a while, he was starting high school. I was still in middle school. So we broke up. And then no matter what happened, it seemed like we always wound up back together. Throughout that whole high school, junior high, middle school thing, we always wound up back together. And then at 20, we had Olivia. So that relationship was just meant to be. She was meant to be, and I think that was the reason we just kept running into each other. Olivia was meant to be here. Yeah. So I was meant to be with him at some point in my life.
But you don't think meant to be with him forever?
Oh, no. No.
What changed?
I will say, after he graduated high school 2 years before me, we got promised engaged. And his granddaddy threw a shit fit. His grandfather was an elder in the Church of God in Christ. And I was a Church of God in Christ. And I didn't care about their ways or the way they thought I should dress.
You had no intentions of converting.
Oh, God, no. And there was just no way. And his granddaddy just basically told them in front of me, with his mom and dad, his brothers, sisters, everybody, he's got 9 brothers and sisters, that I was basically Satan's spawn. I was of the devil, that I was trying to lead him to ruin. I was trying to trick him into marrying me. I was going to get pregnant so he'd have to marry me and all this stuff. I'm like, dude, I'm 17 years old. Mm-hmm. I'm not worried about him. I'm like, I want to go to college. I want to do things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, his granddaddy hated me.
Do you feel that contributed to the breakup? Or?
Oh, God, no. I didn't care what that old man said. I hated his ass anyway. But I got along with the rest of his family. The rest of his family were cool with me. It was just his granddaddy.
Did you all have a song that was yours?
Yeah, but I don't like to think about it. It weirds me out. Even to this day, I can't listen to it.
Wait, you gotta tell me what song it is.
I can't listen to it.
That's fine. We're not gonna hear it, but...
Oh, God. I don't even like to think about it. Yeah, it's still an emotional song. I can't even listen to the band anymore. That's how bad it is. After we broke up, it was just like, okay. And my brother was like, you got to get over this. I'm like, I can't. Mm-hmm. Every time I hear them, I see them, it's just like... Oh no, it brings it all back. So I guess in that little way, that teenage love is still there for me and still in my heart. Mm-hmm. I'm still holding on to it because, I mean, he's a good person and we had a lot of really, really good times. We had a lot of shitty times, but we had a lot of really good times. Mm-hmm. And I like to think about those times, but I don't like to think about that song or the band. So yeah.
So you're not going to tell me that? Uh-uh. No. So you know I'm going to edit this thing. I'm going to put some song in.
I would wager that if one band dominated the bedroom walls of teenage girls in the 1980s, it was of that band with one name said twice, Duran Duran. Think you were the ultimate Durani? Well, can you top this story of fan devotion?
I was talking about them all the time. And also, when I was traveling, and I would send postcards and letters. This was pre-email. And I would send them to my friends. And one of my friends, Connie, just got sick of it because I was always talking Duran Duran. So we made a rubber stamp so that anytime I would send her a letter, on the back of the envelope, I would stamp the envelope and it would say, warning, contents may contain references to Duran Duran.
Really?
Yes.
That's all? Do you still have that?
I'm sure it's somewhere. Yes, right. I'm sure I still have it.
Well, first of all, so people who don't know, where did they get their name?
The name comes from a character in the movie Barbarella, which some may remember is featuring the young Jane Fonda. And there was a bad guy in that character named Durand Durand.
Have you ever heard of a young scientist named Durand Durand?
And where Durand Durand was starting in the city of Birmingham, there were several clubs up and down the street, and they were actually spending a lot of their time at a different club, but one of the clubs along that street was called Barbarella, and so I think that that was what inspired.
So what do you think it was? What was their appeal to you?
Duran Duran, it was the lyrics. They had a very mysterious, almost spiritual quality. Mm-hmm. Plus the videos at the time. Rock videos and MTV were very new at the time. And Duran Duran, they just had these amazing videos. Many of them were directed by a guy named Russell Mulcahy. And his videos were almost like a storyline. It wasn't just showing the band playing on stage, but they'd be going to these exotic locations. They were in Sri Lanka. They were the, one of the videos was sort of like a Raiders of the Lost Ark movie. Another was on a boat, sort of jet setters going around. And especially the video for Hungry Like the Wolf was just so intriguing. What's going on? And he's flipping the table and he's racing through the jungle chasing this woman, and it was a very erotic sort of energy to it. And I think that's what sort of first got my attention. And then they're good-looking guys. And but it was the lyrics. It was Simon's lyrics that really kind of drew me in to just deeper and deeper into it. And in fact, when they at one time the band took a break, and they, instead of Duran Duran, they did some side projects. And one of them, the guitarist and the bass player, I believe, they went off to form a group called Power Station. Mm-hmm. Their lead singer was Robert Palmer. Get it on, bag of gold, get it on. And some very, very good songs on that.
Some Like It Hot, I think.
Mm-hmm. Some Like It Hot, right. Yeah. It was a cover of that. Some feel the heat and decide that they can't go on. And then Simon Le Bon, the lead singer, and the keyboardist Nick Rhodes went off and formed a group called Arcadia. And some of the Arcadia albums, they actually put codes and ciphers into the artwork of the albums. It was a series of numbers.
It was like calling to you, right?
Right. And then when I first saw this, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a code, which I saw very, very quickly. And I was very actually disappointed because I was traveling around the world at the time, and everywhere I went, I was trying to buy every Duran Duran single or album that I could get, every version of it. And in some other countries, when they released the Arcadia albums, they put numbers in the artwork, but because they didn't know what the numbers didn't mean anything. And I found that very frustrating because they hadn't known it was a cipher.
Okay, so the secret message in Arcadia?
It was just very simple. It said the name of the album, So Red the Rose, and then also the names of the band members. It was what's called a monoalphabetic substitution cipher where letters were assigned to numbers. Pretty simple stuff, but right. I was very excited.
But it wasn't key codes to their apartments or anything?
Not to my knowledge, no. But okay. Though when I was in London, I did spend some energy figuring out where all the band members lived, and I did a pilgrimage to Birmingham so I could see the club, and I actually had one of the local fans there. Though the club was locked, she showed me a secret way in by climbing in through a window the back of the club. Yeah, it was quite the adventure for me. And one of the reasons I was there is because Simon Le Bon, the lead singer, was involved in a round-the-world sailing race. It was called the Whitbread Round-the-World Race. And he was the co-owner of one of the boats in that race, which was called Drum, D-R-U-M. It's like she was a 70-foot racing sailing yacht, and I was also traveling around the world around that time, and I actually went to New Zealand to see the boats. So the boats, they left England and then they went south and they went around the Horn of Africa and stopped briefly there, and then they went on eastward to New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand, stopping again for some time so everyone could take a rest and they could do repairs. And then the boats went east from New Zealand around the Horn of South America and stopped in Uruguay, Montevideo, and then they continued from there on back to England for the end of the race. And so I was actually in New Zealand at the time that the boats were there. So
is this
a
coincidence?
It was deliberate. It was very deliberate on my part.
I'm glad you're honest about it.
I wanted to see the boat, and I wanted to just be involved in all that excitement around the Whitbread race. And I saw Simon walking by from time to time. And then the boats went east, which was this grand thing. Like, it seemed like every boat in New Zealand came out to see the boats of the Whitbread heading east. And the boats headed east, and then I headed west, and I went across Asia, and I spent some time in Kathmandu and Nepal, and then eventually worked my way to England and got there at the same time as the boats arrived at the end of the race.
Wow.
So we got to see the boats, and it wasn't like a horse race where it's a photo finish, nose right. by nose, instead of like, oh, there's a boat, and then a couple hours later, oh, there's another boat.
Wow.
But it was fun, and again, I saw famous people walking by. I saw Simon's wife Yasmin was there as well, and there were many fans as well. That's how I met some of the other fans. Eventually, then I went to Birmingham, and some of those fans showed me around the Duran Duran sort of pilgrimage sites at the time.
Did you ever get to meet the band members?
No, I saw them many times. I have many pictures of them, but I wouldn't call it a meeting. It was like I was within 20 feet of them is probably the closest I could say. I believe I met Simon's brother a few times, and I was aboard drum. I was aboard drum several times. I met several members of the crew. Mm-hmm. I'd help them clean up from time to time, wrapping up the sails. And drum had actually had a disaster which had been south of England, where the mast had cracked off and the boat had actually capsized. Right. And Simon and several other people had been trapped inside the boat at the time. They didn't know if they were going to live or die. They were rescued, but I actually went to that spot where the boat had capsized, not in the water, but along the shore. I talked to the people who saw the boat capsize and who called for emergency help. And I also was aboard drum, and I saw the place where part of the hull had been damaged, and I talked to other people that had been aboard at the time that it happened. And I remember one of them, I asked him, I said, so you saw the hull sort of wavering in and out. What was that like? And he paused and he thought about it, and he said it was like watching a heart beating.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was very, very moving for me. And I even wrote some fiction at the time about a story about drum from the point of view of drum being a sort of a sentient boat and what it was like to be in this race and what it was like to carry people. If you've read the story by Anne McCaffrey, The Ship Who Sang, I don't remember if I'd read that story at that time, but there were similarities in there. The idea of the boat feeling the sense of protectiveness towards the people who were aboard her.
I never thought of it until you mentioned it. I guess there is fan fiction about everything from Harry Potter to Star Trek or something, but I guess it would be for bands as well.
I was absolutely writing fan fiction. Yeah, way before the internet. And then later on, when I see all this stuff on the internet and with fanfic, I'm like, oh, they call it fanfic. That's what they call it. Well, I invented it on my own.
Right.
Well, thanks for joining this jog down the Electric Avenue, and look out for future episodes on the same frequency. I also want to thank all my guests who came back by the 80s woodpile, including Jill Clendening, Gracita Guerra-Wolbright, Danica Bryce, Kelly Harris, Chuck Cinelli, DJ Jatpuck, Kristen Bell, Alanka Dunan, and my mom and my sister Stacy. In the Corner Back by the Woodpile podcast is produced by A Closet, A Pocket, and A Suitcase. You can email us at spuncounterguy@hotmail.com. And you can find us on Twitter at SpunCounterGuy. And a special thanks to thebrofisticate.com. But I want